Happy New Year, everybody. Since January 1st is on a Sunday, that will shift the schedule for traditional New Year's bowl games. Reminded me of the 1966 season when the Cowboys and Packers played the NFL championship game on January 1st, 1967 at the Cotton Bowl in that stadium. And Georgia played SMU the afternoon before. Legendary groundskeeper George Toma talked about how he had to quickly get the field ready in a very short period of time for that NFL championship game. He shared that in episode 54 of the Game Before the Money podcast. I bring that up to you partially because I've put together a collection of highlights for you of great stories from the Game Before the Money podcast and package them into the show. That doesn't mean I'm not going to talk contemporary football, but there are stories that you're not going to want to miss from several NFL legends. But I'm also going to dive into the college football playoff. I really like these matchups. Georgia against Ohio State, Michigan against TCU. I'm going to point out subtle things to watch in each game that I think are going to make a difference. As always, I hope it elevates your appreciation for what's happening on the field and give you a better picture of how the games might turn out. I'm Jackson Michael. This is the Game Before the Money on the SportsMap Radio Network and the SportsMap Radio app. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com and subscribe to the Game Before the Money podcast on your favorite podcast app. All right, it's the college football playoff. The two games on New Year's Eve will be top seed Georgia against fourth-ranked Ohio State, and second-ranked Michigan against third-ranked TCU. Let's take a look at these matchups, starting with Michigan against TCU. These teams will play each other in the Fiesta Bowl. These schools have never played each other before, despite the long histories of each program. This is only Michigan's second time in the Fiesta Bowl. The other time was when head coach Jim Harbaugh was the Wolverines quarterback. TCU is 12-1 and has won 12 games for the fifth time in school history. Michigan is 13-0, and that's the first time Michigan has won 13 games in one season. The Wolverines' 25 wins over the past 2 years is the most in school history over a two-season stretch. This is a very special period in Michigan Wolverines football history. TCU defeated 5 ranked teams this season. That is tied with Tennessee for the most. I've thought a lot about this game, and the biggest thing that stands out to me that can make or break it is TCU's ability to make the big play versus Michigan's ability to stop it. TCU had 29 plays of 50 yards or more this season. 29 plays in 13 games. That's easy math. That's averaging more than 2 per game. So I think that's going to be the thing that could really decide this game, whether TCU can keep up that explosiveness against the Wolverine defense. If Michigan can shut that down, it could be a long night for TCU. If TCU hits like they have been, well, that could be a different story. They've got one kid, Tay Barber, who's made 3 catches of at least 70 yards this year. They've got another player, Darius Davis, who has scored touchdowns in 4 different ways this year: receiving, rushing, via punt return, and kickoff return. So I wouldn't be surprised if this is going to be the real defining aspect of this game. How many huge plays can TCU get off this Michigan defense? And the other way around. Michigan is formidable in that regard. But TCU is as explosive as any team in the country. If Michigan's able to quiet that, that's going to be a huge advantage for them, especially considering how dominating the Wolverines can be in terms of time of possession. Georgia against Ohio State. These teams will play in the Peach Bowl. They have only played each other once. That was in the Citrus Bowl in 1993. Georgia won that game 21-14. Throughout the vast majority of the season, I personally thought that these were the two best teams in college football. That, of course, was until the Michigan at Ohio State game. And Michigan exposed a really surprisingly vulnerable Ohio State secondary, and especially a weakness against the run. That susceptibility showed in the fourth quarter with two long runs by Michigan, in which there literally wasn't anybody there in the secondary to cover the area the running back was running towards. So that's a big question for me going into this game. Is Ohio State still vulnerable to those types of running plays that Michigan had huge success with late in the game? Secondly, Georgia's been here before, and they know how to win. They showed winning experience in that game against Tennessee, and experience like that can get magnified in these playoff scenarios. I see this game going one of two possible directions. One, Georgia wins it big by more than two scores. That's if Georgia is really clicking by the end of the first half. It's really hard to predict because the teams in the playoffs, they haven't played for a few weeks. A lot of times there's rust that needs to be shaken off. But Georgia won the championship last year. And again, I think that experience is key. I also think the middle of their defensive line, having a guy like Jalen Carter, having a guy like Stackhouse in the middle of that defense could cause some problems for Ohio State. The Buckeyes have one of the best linemen in the country at tackle in Paris Johnson Jr. And that's the outside of the line. Ohio State's interior linemen are good, but they're going to have to be great against Georgia. That is a matchup. Those interior linemen, when Ohio State has the ball, that is a matchup that I think is going to go a long way in determining this game. So watch how Ohio State's center and guards do against Georgia's defensive tackles. If Ohio State is able to win that battle, that's going to really improve their chances to win. Otherwise, I really think Georgia has a high chance of controlling this game. The second possible direction that this game could go, from my view, is that it's a close game, and it's that type of game that would give Ohio State a real chance to win. I would be very surprised if the Buckeyes blew out Georgia. Ohio State is an excellent football team, and if they're able to shore up the secondary play in this game, it could be a great game to watch. I do see this matchup as having some real potential to have momentum swings multiple times throughout the game. And those types of games are usually awesome to watch. Both of these teams have the capability of gaining momentum and holding it, as well as taking it away from the other team. The Buckeyes have scored at least 40 points in 9 of their games, but Georgia's defense has held 6 teams to their lowest point totals of the season, including Oregon and Tennessee. Another thing to watch on Georgia's side of things, they're very good at blocking kicks. 5 players on their roster have blocked a kick at some point in their careers. Georgia is averaging almost 40 points a game on offense and is holding teams to about 12 points per game, When you have point differentials like that, it's really tough to not just beat that team, but to even contend with that team. I do believe that Ohio State is one of the few teams that has the talent to contend with Georgia. Now, breaks are things that can change games. And my hunch is that Ohio State is going to need more of them to win this. This is the winningest class in Georgia history. So that alone tells you something about how good this team is. I'm very interested to see how this Ohio State team matches up, because Ohio State now holds the all-time record for most consecutive games scoring at least 20 points. They've done it for 73 straight games now. The last time Ohio State scored fewer than 20 points in a game was in 2017. But Georgia is both the number one team in the country in the red zone on both offense and defense. The Bulldogs have only missed scoring twice all season once they've gotten into the red zone. Georgia also has the best run defense in the country, and the Bulldogs are in the top three in third down defense in the country. You look at these stats, and Georgia looks to have a lot of advantages coming into this game. Here's the wild card and something that could really spin this game, and that's turnovers. Ohio State is plus 7 in turnovers this year, and Georgia is even. I said that I think Ohio State is likely going to need to get a few extra breaks in this game to win. And if you're looking for where those possible breaks might come from, underline that turnover margin difference. I'm Jackson Michael. This is The Game Before the Money. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. The Game Before the Money podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts and at thegamebeforethemoney.com. Most episodes feature NFL legends sharing great stories. I put together a sample of some of these stories for you. Here is San Francisco 49ers Hall of Fame linebacker Dave Wilcox. One of the many awesome stories that he shared was about playing against the great Gale Sayers of the Chicago Bears. Gale Sayers scored 6 touchdowns in one game against the 49ers in 1965. That tied the record for most touchdowns in a single game, and it's only been matched a handful of times in NFL history. Here's Pro Football Hall of Fame linebacker Dave Wilcox talking about another Hall of Famer, Gale Sayers, from episode 56 of the Game Before the Money podcast.
You know, and we laugh about this all the time. I don't know if the coaches didn't like us or what, but I played in a game in Chicago in Wrigley Field on the infield dirt and mud, I should say, when a guy named Gale Sayers scored 6 touchdowns. And I remember in our practices and stuff, I said, okay, now when Sayers run this, I want you to do that. And I'm going, when Sayers does whatever he wants to do, we can't do anything to stop him.
Gale Sayers' 6 touchdowns in one game remains tied as an NFL record for most touchdowns in one game. As of the start of the 2021 season, he's tied with Ernie Nevers, Dub Jones, and now Alvin Kamara, who tied that record in 2020. You can hear Dub Jones speak about his 6 touchdown game in 1951 on the Game Before the Money podcast, featuring Dub Jones. That is episode number 17. Wilcox said he made light of Gale Sayers' 6 touchdown day when the two players met each other at the Pro Bowl that season.
I think it was that same year I got to go to the Pro Bowl, and I remember walking into the locker room for the first time, and Gale Sayers was on our team, and I walked in to get my ankles taped, and Gale Sayers is sitting on the table waiting to get his ankles taped. I said, Gale, my name's Dave Wilcox. I'd like to introduce myself. I've never got to see you close up before, and just wanted to see what you looked like, because on the field you couldn't get close to it.
So there you have it from Hall of Fame linebacker Dave Wilcox about the only way for a defensive player to catch up to Gale Sayers is in the locker room at the Pro Bowl. Wilcox made 7 Pro Bowls in his illustrious career that led him to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. All right, again, you can hear more great stories from Hall of Fame linebacker Dave Wilcox in episode number 56 of the Game Before the Money podcast. Many of you might remember a great linebacker for the Denver Broncos named Carl Mecklenburg. And one thing that I love to do on the Game Before the Money podcast is hear these stories about how guys overcame a lot just to get their shot at the NFL. Carl Mecklenburg discussed his long journey to even get to the Denver Broncos in episode number 28 of the Game Before the Money podcast.
I left Augustana and I walked on at the University of Minnesota. When you transfer between 4-year colleges, you're ineligible to play for that first year, but you can certainly practice. So my job that year was to be a live blocking dummy. I'm pretending to be the guy from Michigan or Ohio State or whoever we're playing that week. If I want to eat with the team, I've got to sweep up the weight room or sweep up the locker room. Usually they put your jersey number on your laundry bag. The number on my laundry bag was number 110. Right? There's no 110 in football, but that was me.
When I introduced Carl's journey to success at the top of the program, I wasn't kidding when I said that it's a statement to hard work and dedication. This future All-Pro wasn't above cleaning the locker room simply to get his cleats onto the practice field. And being handed the number 110, that's enough to dishearten even some of the most talented athletes. Mecklenburg worked hard, and his fortunes changed.
But I was a great practice player, and as soon as I was eligible for a full scholarship, they gave me one because I was eating up their guys in practice. My junior year at Minnesota, I led the Big Ten in sacks, tied with Andre Tippett.
The Golden Gophers moved into the new Metrodome during Carl's senior season. The team didn't perform as well, and he tells us how that affected his NFL draft status.
My senior year, we were bad. We won our first 3 games. We had just moved to the Metrodome, and the Metrodome turf was really bad at first. They hadn't figured it out yet. We had a bunch of guys hurt. And so we won our first 3 and lost our last 8. When you're behind all the time, nobody passes, so I didn't ever get a chance to rush the passer. So my draft status dropped a bit, and I ended up a 12th round draft pick for the Broncos. 310th pick of the draft, 20 guys away from Mr. Irrelevant. That's the last guy picked. So I was not your 5-star guy. I was a guy who had overcome and overcome and overcome. And truthfully, a lot of those 5-star guys get to training camp in the NFL, and they don't know how to overcome. They've never had to. They've always been the best player on their team. For me, I got to training camp, and I said, oh, here I go again. Right? I'm going to figure out a way.
Remember how his first number in Minnesota was number 110 and how hard he needed to work to get a scholarship? Mecklenburg found himself in a similar situation when he arrived at the Denver Broncos training camp. Jersey numbers just seemed to keep popping up as part of his story.
You know, actually, I had the same number as a starter. That's never a good sign when you get there. I had the same number as a starter, then they switched me to another number, and then they fired somebody and gave me his number, so I ended up with 77. That was the 3rd number I had during training camp that year. And when they switched me to linebacker, they tried to change my number again. And I'm like, nah, my mom's not going to be able to figure out which one I am. I'm going to keep 77. So that was that's how I ended up with 77.
Great stories from Carl Mecklenburg in episode 28 of the Game Before the Money podcast. I also like to cover details of NFL history that are kind of forgotten. For example, Bears owner George Halas made arrangements for several of his players to go to med school during the NFL season. One of those players was Bill McCall. Bill McCall shared details about his arrangement with George Halas and shared details about the 1956 NFL championship game. in episode number 55 of the Game Before the Money podcast.
I wrote everybody and told them that I wasn't going to play football unless I could keep up my medical studies. And Hallis was the only one who accepted that. He called me and said, you know, I think we can work it out.
McCall says that George Hallis kept his word. He allowed McCall to prioritize his medical studies amidst his NFL career.
When I signed my contract with Hallis, I said, if medicine and football ever conflicted, I'd have to be able to stick with the medicine. And so he said yes. And so I missed a lot of meetings and so forth. But one time, just before we were going to play the Rams, he said, Bill, it's really important you come because we're playing the Rams the next week. I said, but George, you promised. And he said, yes, I did. You don't have to come.
Some people think that the 1956 NFL Championship was similar to the 1934 NFL Championship game that's famously referred to as the sneakers game, in which the Giants wore basketball shoes instead of cleats to get better traction on an iced over field while the Bears fell about the place slipping on ice with their football cleats. McCall says that despite the rumors, that was not the case with the 1956 NFL Championship, and that the Bears equipment manager provided an array of footwear for the 1956 game.
Supposedly, it was duplicating the icy field of 20 years before that, and that the Giants supposedly wore tennis shoes and the Bears didn't. But that isn't really true. The Bears had six different types of shoes in our bag for the game, and different people wore different kinds. What I really remember was that the Giants were playing well and we played poorly. We fumbled and they'd recover. We'd throw a pass and they'd interception. And so anyway, I just think that some days you're on, some days you're off, and it was a day that the Giants were on and the Bears were off.
McCall finished both 1955 and 1956 as the Bears' second leading receiver behind Harlan Hill, who was named the NFL's MVP in 1955. Bill McCall continued his medical training while playing for the Bears. In 1958, he led the Bears in receptions, receiving yards, and touchdown receptions. His eight touchdown receptions tied him for third in the NFL behind Raymond Berry and Tommy McDonald, two Hall of Fame receivers that ended up with only one more touchdown catch than McCall that season. That was a quick sample of what you'll hear from former Bears receiver Bill McCall in episode number 55 of the Game Before the Money podcast. Dr. McCall is 92 years young, and he shared a lot of great pro and college football history. I'm Jackson Michael. This is the Game Before the Money. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. Back with more highlights from the Game Before the Money podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts and at thegamebeforethemoney.com. You can also subscribe for free on your favorite podcast app. Upton Bell, son of former NFL commissioner Burt Bell, did a three-part series of games that changed the NFL. In episode number 48 of the Game Before the Money podcast, he shared his experiences as an executive for the Baltimore Colts in Super Bowl III. Here's a clip from that podcast episode, including some background about the game. So Super Bowl III is really the first time you have a lot going on around the game that's got nothing to do with football. Then you have a heavy favorite and an underdog that's virtually dismissed by the media. The face of that underdog was Joe Namath, who fans either loved for his flamboyance or despised him for it. But Namath wasn't the only underdog in this fight. A lot of people bring up that Super Bowl III was a victory for the American Football League and forced the old establishment of the NFL to finally recognize that the AFL could play ball. You've probably heard that story before and probably heard it many times. The overlooked, but perhaps most important underdog in Super Bowl III didn't play a down and never put on a helmet that day. He stood on the sidelines wearing a suit and an ill-fitting baseball cap that said Jets on it. His name was Wiebe Eubank. He was head coach of the New York Jets. Eubank previously was head coach of the Baltimore Colts when they won back-to-back NFL championships in 1958 and 1959. Colts owner Carol Rosenblum fired him just a few years later after the 1962 season. Rosenblum's new head coach was a 33-year-old assistant from the Detroit Lions named Don Shula. The Jets, meanwhile, immediately hired Wiebe Eubank.
The key to me to the game was Wiebe. Wiebe knew us better than anybody. We could have gone down as one of the greatest teams of that era. Remember, we only lost one game, and the reason we lost it was earlier to Cleveland because Shula decided to put Unitas in to see if his arm got any better, and he threw, I think, two interceptions, and we were beaten. If not, we would have come into that game unbeaten.
Let's add a couple of things together. Episode 46 of the Game Before the Money podcast was part two in this series and focused on the 1958 NFL championship. Upton told us about Wiebe Eubank's inspiring pregame speech to his Colts players before that championship game against the New York Giants. He called some of the players out by name and reminded them how other teams cut them and didn't believe they could play football. And here was their chance to prove everybody wrong. Exactly 10 years later, Wiebe Eubank found himself in the exact same position. Baltimore Colts owner Carol Rosenblum had told him his performance wasn't good enough, told him he wasn't needed anymore. Now, Wiebe Eubank is entering a championship game against that very team. Super Bowl III was his chance to shock the football world, ruin the Colts' preordained victory party, and fulfill his own pregame speech from the 1958 season. This was his chance to prove Carol Rosenblum wrong. Now, to my knowledge, that backstory didn't get talked about much before the game. The media talked about how great the Colts were, and they were great. On paper, the Jets didn't look much different statistically than the Kansas City and Oakland teams that were demolished by an NFL giant. Games aren't played on paper, though. They're played on the field. Upton talks about some game film that he saw in the Jets in the time leading up to the game.
The feeling was, looking at the film, I thought that they were better than they were being given credit for. And I thought, although it was different in the game, that the key was stopping Namath. They had a decent defense. Jerry Philbin and John Elliott were really good. Al Atkinson, who I drafted and decided to sign with the Jets, they had some really good players, but they weren't very big. But the one thing that I did see is Namath had George Sauer Jr., who later played for me in Charlotte, terrific receiver. He had Don Maynard, Hall of Fame receiver. He had two of the best backs in football in Boozer and Matt Snell. And a decent offensive line. I kind of said, we better be careful here when Lou Michaels and some of the other people were saying, you know, this could be easy.
Upton wasn't the only one in the Colts camp that decided that the New York Jets might be a tougher opponent than the odds makers advertised. In his book, Present at the Creation, Upton wrote that one Colts veteran said he thought that they could score 50 points on the Jets. Colts defensive back Bobby Boyd told him that they might have to, since the Jets had very good receivers along with Joe Namath. It's highly unlikely that Baltimore's head coach Don Shula overlooked the Jets, and the same thing with his assistant coach Chuck Knoll. The Jets were a very good team. The Colts were a great team. That doesn't mean that the NFL was inherently better than the AFL, but in this case, the Colts were likely the best team in pro football that year. They put a 13-1 season together with their second string quarterback, Earl Morrill, who won the NFL's Most Valuable Player Award while Johnny Unitas suffered from that elbow injury. Morrill bounced around the NFL with several teams before arriving in Baltimore in 1968. 2 years before that, he split time with a guy named Gary Wood on the New York Giants as they slugged through a 1-12-1 season, by far the worst record in the NFL that year. Then he backed up Fran Tarkenton the next year, and Tarkenton pulled the team to a 500 mark. Morrill was a journeyman who spent most of his career as a backup, and he caught lightning in a bottle in 1968. So you might say he had a career year, and you might say he played over his head. And that's not just me saying that either. Colts receiver Jimmy Orr wondered the same thing. Upton fills us in.
And Jimmy Orr predicted. He said in the bus coming to the game, he said, "I hope this isn't the day that Earl wakes up," which means, you know, he's been living a charmed life, and will he go back to, you know, a decent to mediocre quarterback? And he did.
That was Upton Bell from episode 48 of the Game Before the Money podcast, giving you backstories to Super Bowl III that you can't get anywhere else. The podcast also covers more recent football history. Baltimore Ravens center Matt Burke shared about the famous Mile High Miracle in episode number 41 of the Game Before the Money podcast. I asked Matt Berg about what it was like in the Ravens huddle before the play, and his answer gave insight into that team's mentality and the focus on the task at hand.
Joe's the perfect example of a guy that never gets too excited or too down. I mean, even we went out there down by 7 and I had a minute left, had to go the length of the field. It was never like, oh, geez, we got to do this, or guys, you know, we're going to lose. It was just like, what's the play? Okay, that's the play. Here's my assignment. Let's execute. Didn't worry about the outcome at all. Just worried about the task at hand. And I'd love to tell you that I just knew by looking in Joe's eye that we were going to win. I didn't. I never checked Joe's eyes to see if we thought we were going to win. It didn't matter. It was just about the moment and executing and doing your job. And then, you know, the results take care of themselves. I mean, you know, that play where we tied it up, that was a great play, but it was, I don't know if it was great offense or if it was bad defense. The bottom line is we executed and they didn't. But I do think it was symbolic of our team. Our team that year, we had our share of adversity with injuries. We had a losing streak in December, which nobody ever wants as you're going into the playoffs. Mm-hmm. But we just kept fighting, and we overcame all of it.
If you get a chance to see a clip of that play, you'll see Matt Burke make two key blocks. He forces the nose tackle to the right and towards another blocker. He next keeps Von Miller from getting to Joe Flacco as Flacco steps up in the pocket and launches the ball downfield. After seeing that, I asked Matt about his own personal role on that play.
Yeah, I'd love to tell you it's some great play by me, but obviously it's not. You just do what you're trained to do, nothing more, nothing less. And you know, in that particular look, they're only rushing three guys. You don't vacate your area. You maintain they call it the depth of the pocket so the quarterback can step up. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've been in that similar situation, I don't know, a million times in my career.
In episode number 6 of the Game Before the Money podcast, Rams legend Eddie Metter shared stories about Deacon Jones and head coach George Allen.
Deacon was quite a character and one heck of a ball player. And he was the beginning of the fearsome foursome.
The fearsome foursome was the Rams' defensive line in the 1960s, featuring Lamar Lundy at defensive end with Deacon Jones. The Rams would then draft defensive tackle Merlin Olsen out of Utah State in 1962, and then in 1963, acquire Rosie Greer from the New York Giants. In the late 1960s, Roger Brown would become part of that group, playing defensive tackle, coming over from the Detroit Lions after Rosie Greer retired. To this day, that defensive line is still recognized as one of the greatest defensive lines in NFL history. Eddie tells us what it was like to play behind that defensive line, as well as a pretty solid set of linebackers.
I think it certainly helped the secondary because the pressure that those guys can put on a quarterback. It was just a pleasure to play behind those guys. And, of course, the linebackers that we had with Jack Pardee and Les Richter and Maxie Bond and guys like that, too. With those seven guys, the pressure on the quarterback was tremendous. It made it, I think, a little bit easier on us defensive backs.
Commentators and reporters covering today's NFL would use terms such as ball hawk and defensive playmaker to describe Eddie Medder's play. According to the USA Today, Eddie not only holds the Rams team record in interceptions, but also fumble recoveries and blocked kicks. In fact, the USA Today credits him with 10 career blocked kicks.
Maybe I had a little bit of a nose for the football. I just tried my best to turn the ball over some way through our offense.
Having a nose for the football often put Eddie in the thick of the action. And in the world of pro football, it can also be dangerous. Eddie tells us about a violent collision he had with Packers running back Paul Hornung.
He come through the line of scrimmage and hit me with his knee on, I guess it was the left side of the helmet, and cracked that thing all the way to the top.
The Rams discarded Eddie's cracked helmet, gave him a new one, and he played the rest of the game.
And I didn't remember a whole lot in that ball game, at least for 30 or 40 minutes I didn't. Back then, they would break melon sauce in front of you and get back in there, son, and play.
In 1966, the Los Angeles Rams hired George Allen as head coach.
Probably the greatest coach that I ever had. He was 120% football. He's the kind of guy that if you go into the practice session and say, good morning, coach, he'll say, boy, you got to watch that Raymond Berry. He's tough, and you better be thinking about him a lot. Everything he was about football.
This is The Game Before the Money. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. One last great highlight from the Game Before the Money podcast. In episode number 65, Seahawks legend Sean Alexander shared how he was friends with two other NFL legends while they were in high school. Here's an excerpt from episode 65 of the Game Before the Money podcast with some background info on Sean Alexander's high school career. Everything started at Boone County High School in Florence, Kentucky. His on-the-field performance earned him the Mr. Football Award in Kentucky. That's how he became friends with two other future NFL legends who were also in high school at the time.
I still laugh because now that we're getting older, we get to have those stories where, you know, cell phones wasn't how it was back then, and Instagram and all these things, but I went to almost every high school game. Being Mr. Football from Kentucky, and I traveled with Mr. Ohio and Mr. Western Virginia just about every game. And who was that? Charles Woodson and Randy Moss. We didn't know who we was at the time. You know what I mean? Like, that's the little thing that media does, or social media does, is like they get everybody connected. Well, you know, we laugh now. You know, Charles gets inducted in the Hall of Fame and the Raiders, you know, thing, and he'll send me a text, bro, you gonna be able to come? You know, no one would know that we're that close, just because there wasn't a thing back then, you know?
So you guys knew each other even when you were
high school.
In high school.
High school, yeah. It's kind of wild, like, yeah. You know, and it was just really sweet because I was one of the first athletes with those guys that ESPN followed around, you know what I mean? So that's back in 93, 94, 95, you know? And so us having all those flashback memories are just fun.
Happy New Year. Thanks for listening to The Game Before the Money. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com and subscribe to The Game Before the Money podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay.